Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving, back again.
And I'm Ken Rudin, and welcome home, Ron.
It's good to be back.
Well, while you were gone, there was an incursion in the nation of Libya. I think
I'm sorry to hear that. Yes, I'm very sorry to hear that.
Because President Bush... Oh, no, it wasn't President Bush.
No, it wasn't President Bush.
It was
the second President Bush.
No. It was President Obama who sent a letter to Congress saying that, as Commander-in-Chief, I'm constitutionally able to do that.
And everybody... A letter?
Yes.
He sent a whole letter?
Actually, it was several words. It wasn't just a letter.
Oh, it was not. It was several words.
It was more than a letter. Yeah.
And how long was this missive?
It was two pages.
Two whole pages? And that, of course, satisfied Congress, and they were glad to hear that communication.
And they voted overwhelmingly to approve the mission. Oh, wait a second.
There wasn't. Well, all right. Let's be fair. Congress was already on its way out of town and is out all week this week. And therefore, if they had been here, I'm sure the administration would have asked for a vote of full.
Well, here's a good question.
What would we call it? Not a declaration of war.
No, we haven't had that.
I understand the Secretary of State has already said we are not at war with Libya.
No.
We are bombing the living bejesus out of them, but we're not at war.
I think it was Patrick Henry Clinton who said, give me Libya or give me death.
No, yes. That is really, really right on your usual standard.
Thank you. Not bad.
Not too bad.
Okay, but if you were John Boehner, and Speaker John Boehner, and who was complaining about lack of consultation with Congress, would you have called, should you have called Congress back into session last week instead of doing the work period?
An interesting question, because does Congress really want to be called back into session to decide whether or not to okay our participation in an international effort to try to restrain Muammar Gaddafi, long-time acknowledged crazy person?
And the answer to last week's scuttle button puzzle.
Coincidence? You decide.
I think not.
So I wonder if Congress would have actually wanted to have the ball in its court, in the sense that if they didn't approve the action that the president was contemplating taking, obviously a lot of people in Benghazi would have been massacred by the Gaddafi forces that were on the verge of doing that at the time that the international force intervened with their aerial bombardment, really. I mean, they call it a no-fly zone, but what they're doing is they're zapping any asset of Muammar Gaddafi's forces they can see in their gun sights.
Yeah, I don't think the complaint from Congress is so much that the mission was undertaken, but that they were not consulted. And, of course, yeah, exactly. I know the face you're making, and you're right.
It's always more than that. I mean, Congress can always say we weren't consulted because, let's face it, what president has consulted Congress thoroughly before taking action?
Iraq.
You're talking about the first Persian
Gulf War? No, I'm talking about 2003.
Oh, the authorization of what, though? What did they authorize?
To give the president the use of force, to take use of force in Iraq, not to overthrow Saddam
Hussein.
Not to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
And not, of course, you know, what exactly happened
but
in March of 2003. But
we're doing Gulf of Tonkin. Everything is a Gulf of Tonkin, right?
Everything is a Gulf of Tonkin. But Congress would have at least liked to have had the chance to be put in an uncomfortable position and given the opportunity to vote against something they couldn't possibly have voted against.
And the two senators who voted against Gulf of Tonkin?
Ernest Gruening.
That's Crete. That's correct. That's Crete. That's correct.
And Wayne Morse.
That is correct.
Could I have a high five, please?
You have a high five.
Thank you very much.
But it's not only the Republicans who are carping, there are Democrats as well. And yet you wonder that had George W. Bush sent Congress a letter saying I'm president and I'm commander-in-chief and I'm constitutionally empowered to do this.
To send cruise missiles. The Constitution specifically said cruise missiles are okay.
Here's the thing, though. This is a constitutional part of our country. Our Congress, our Republican-led House, at least, is very aware of the Constitution. And I think there's more arguments, perhaps there's more arguments from Republicans. Of course, it's a Democratic president, but there seems to be more talking about the Constitution now than we heard in 2003.
Fair point. And I do believe there are a number of Democrats who are so in the habit of objecting to presidential overreach with respect to use of the military that they are not letting the fact that Barack Obama is of their party keep them from going out and criticizing this move by the administration and by President Obama, the commander-in-chief. Among them, of course, Dennis Kucinich, sometime presidential candidate, person who has been highly critical of all Republican incursions into other countries. He was out there away saying
it's not a Republican
this president
thing. I think
too,
he's just anti-war.
He is. Yeah. He is anti-war. And there are others too, Walter Jones from North Carolina. Former Democrat, now a Republican. He has also been, and Ron Paul, who has been very consistent about opposing use of military force overseas, or for that matter, keeping as many troops around the world as we have kept in the number of bases that we have around the world. He's been against that from, I suppose, in some people's view, an isolation isolationist kind of point of view, like what business do we have being in all these places, but also from a budgetary point of view and saying this is where your money is going. This is why we have a $600 billion defense budget.
But what is the policy, though? I mean, yes, there was a Security Council located and the Arab League located, but is it to drive out Gaddafi? What happens if this no-fly zone bombing doesn't stop anything?
Well, and it has stopped something. It stopped the massacre of Benghazi.
It has.
This time. That much has been accomplished. Now, we've also degraded all of the Libyan Air Force, which was not one of the great air forces of the world, but had some capabilities, and we have bombed them.
It was no Liechtenstein. Okay.
We have bombed them back into the 1960s. I don't know. We've degraded their airports and shot down their planes. At this point, Gaddafi cannot very effectively deal with the rebels, but the rebels can't very effectively deal with Gaddafi. So we have a stalemate, and that stalemate could go on indefinitely. And the United States is in a position where we have led this coalition. We're trying to hand off control of the coalition and say, we'd love somebody else to lead the coalition, but nobody else wants to step into that
NATO?
Role.
Why isn't NATO not involved?
NATO is not involved because a couple of countries in NATO are reluctant to have NATO step into that role, including Turkey.
Right.
Here's Turkey out there saying, well, you know what? We're here to give you the point of view from the Muslim world. And from the Muslim world's point of view, this looks kind of weird. It looks like Europeans coming to North Africa and trying to tell Muslims what to do.
Once again.
And, of course, it's all the history that matters here rather than the specific events of the present because Benghazi was saved. Now, we could be just as easily sitting here doing this podcast and talking about how in the world could we have dithered and let the Benghazis
we would have heard that if nothing happened, of course.
And so here we are. The president had to make a choice. Congress was not in position to do anything in a timely fashion. The president acted, and so now he's being second-guessed from both directions. He's caught in the crossfire again.
We have second-guessing not only of the war in Libya, but of the healthcare overhaul bill that celebrated its one-year anniversary this
week.
Let's
break out the music.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
And, of course, it has been fully implemented and is running our national healthcare system
today.
Well,
of course. It's not 2014. We don't have the uninsured insured yet.
Finally something we can agree on. It is not 2014.
That's right. But what the nation can't seem to agree with, at least yet, is that whether it's a success or not. Of course, there's a lot to happen that hasn't happened yet, but they're still debating whether this is a success.
I love the polls on this. You've got people who are saying, we like the law. You have people saying, we really hate the law. They took over the whole healthcare system. And then you have people who are saying, oh, that? It's been repealed. I think something like 1 out of 5 or more than 1 out of 5, almost 1 out of 4, say in response to questions about it, oh, that was repealed.
I haven't seen that, really.
Because the House of Representatives of the United States of America has voted to repeal it. And a certain number of people look down at the newspaper. They see Congress voting on the health care bill. They're going to repeal it. Their level of information is not particularly high, and they believe that the bill has been repealed. The law has been repealed.
Is this the same group of people who convinced where Barack Obama was actually born?
Which includes Donald Trump, by the way.
So the polls are mixed on that. I think more people say that they're not happy with it than are happy with it.
Who could be happy with it? Except people who think that it consists entirely of the pre-existing conditions thing.
Which doesn't happen yet.
And the you can keep your kid on your health insurance until they're 26 thing, which people like.
Right.
But most of the law has not happened.
I think the real story about health care and how it plays in 2012 is how Mitt Romney is able to navigate his Romney care with what was derided by Republicans as Obamacare.
Now, I know that you are a granular detail kind of expert
on
both the Obamacare and the Romney care. Are they the same?
No, they're not. Because
I guess we've laid that one to rest.
Because I'll tell you why. Because Romney is a Republican, so that is a good bill.
I think you're being unfair because Mitt Romney, all right, there's a partisan thing, Republican, Democrat, sure. But he has a point when he says, what I did in Massachusetts stayed in Massachusetts. I didn't try to make the other 49
that
states sit still for it.
Yeah, and that's Romney's argument. Romney's argument is that unlike Obamacare, what I proposed, what I did in Massachusetts, even though it was changed by the Democratic legislature, what I did was really one state. It's not that one model fits all. That's the Republican argument. But you notice that the White House is very eager to tweak Mitt Romney, saying, good job, Mitt. You know, we're basing our whole health care plan on what you did in Massachusetts.
Yes, and of course also saying they could never have gotten it passed without the help of John Huntsman. But we'll get to John Huntsman and Mitt Romney in just a moment. The interesting thing here is that the health care debate is going to go into the presidential campaign. It's going to influence who steps out. And I find it hard to believe Mitt Romney's going to be able to sell that line about, well, I was only doing Massachusetts, because his opponents will say, well, yeah, but if you'd been president, you could have done it to the whole country. And that's what Barack Obama did.
And the Democrats have found quotes from Mitt Romney back in the day where he said this could be the model for the whole country.
He was exactly right. So he's got a problem
he
with
does.
That. Obviously, the Obama administration and the reelection campaign of President Obama are going to have a major problem with it, too, because it's a piecemeal kind of deal. People are going to have different kinds of experience with it. And there lingers a sense that whether it was a good law or a bad law, the way it was enacted was not good process. And that in and of itself was unpopular. There's no question that that part of it was unpopular, the way it was enacted.
The race for the Republican nomination seems to be accelerating somewhat. We had the spectacle of Tim Pawlenty announcing exploratory committee this week.
Join the team and together we'll restore America.
Okay, we're being pulled into this already. We've been talking about Romney. We've been talking a little about John Huntsman. I have this very day opened up on my computer the rankings of the top 15 Republican candidates for president in 2012 from a highly reputable national journalistic organization, the National Journal, and they are using one of their operations called The Hotline, for which, Ken, I believe you were
the
managing
editor. Yes,
that's right. So this is one of your alma maters. I don't mean to in any way impugn the journalism here. I just want to point out who these people are. Now, this is a serious news organization. They're talking about Mitt Romney. They've got Tim Pawlenty as the number two candidate behind Romney.
I think that's fair.
And then their number three prospect for the Republican nomination in 2012 is Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi. The fourth is Newt Gingrich. The fifth is Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, whom they do not believe, in the end, is actually a candidate. Mike Huckabee.
Yeah, I'm not convinced Haley Barbour and Newt Gingrich are candidates either, or for the long run anyway. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. We know Romney's running. We know Pawlenty is running.
Right.
Haley Barbour, I think that's a 50-50 call. He's been making the moves. He's out there. He's doing
it. Hiring staff.
He can apparently raise money. We know that he has tremendous connections in the lobbying world since he is a proud lobbyist and doesn't try to duck
it. And he was a very successful Republican operative. There's no question. When he was RNC chair in 93-94, he helped engineer the takeover of Congress. A great party guy.
As a backroom
guy. Right.
As an organizer, not as the frontman candidate.
Right.
The only thing he's ever won as a frontman candidate is the governorship of Mississippi.
Two terms, right.
A springboard, as we have seen over time, to another term as governor of Mississippi.
You don't remember President Ray Mabus?
I don't remember any presidents from Mississippi, quite frankly, and I don't remember any nominees of the Republican or the Democratic Party from Mississippi. This is a small state with a difficult reputation, and let's face it, Haley Barbour's not been making it any easier with the remarks that he's made. I won't say they're insensitive, but they sound insensitive to many with respect to race and the history
Matter
of Mississippi.
Fact, as I'm sitting here thinking, the last presidential person on the ticket from Mississippi that I could think of was Governor Fielding Wright, who was Strom Thurmond's running mate on the anti-civil rights 1948 Dixiecrat ticket. So Mississippi is not a springboard for national office.
Newt Gingrich? Is there a person somewhere who really imagines Newt Gingrich being elected president of the United States?
Besides
Newt Gingrich?
Well, okay, we're already on like number five and number six. Go back to the
Democrats. Right, Mitch Daniels, Mike Huckabee.
Yeah.
Now, I think Mike Huckabee would be a reasonable candidate. He's running almost even.
He's made a lot of mistakes.
He has.
He's running
almost even with Mitt Romney. They're both at about 20% among Republicans.
We're not in March 2011 talking about polls for 2012.
All right. But you
As
cannot,
President Hillary Clinton would tell you.
But you cannot dismiss the fact that a couple of guys who ran for president in 2008 are back in it this time, and they're running about
so
neck and
presumably
neck.
Romney and Huckabee.
Romney and Huckabee. But I think most people are looking at Huckabee and saying, he's not going to run. He's somebody who has a very successful life now, which he could, in some sense, jeopardize by getting out there in Iowa and New Hampshire and getting his head handed to him.
Well, I mean, it's the old Pat Buchanan thing. I mean, he always had a job on cable TV until he ran for president, then he went back to cable TV again. Mike Huckabee is still selling books, going to Iowa and New Hampshire, so one would think that he is planning to run.
He is selling books. Everybody's selling books. Mitch Daniels has a book.
Right.
Everybody's got a book. Sarah Palin has more books than you could put on a shelf. And Sarah Palin, by the way, is the next one on this list, right there with Michelle Bachmann. Not exactly a household name, largely known as the spokeswoman, if you will, for the Tea Party caucus in the House, but not a household name, I don't believe, even among Tea Party members.
No, but again, we've established a long time ago that this race is a very slow-forming race. Nobody's a household name yet.
Okay, let's just...
Jimmy Carter was Jimmy Who for the longest time.
He was the former governor of Georgia.
Right.
And he had been on the cover of Time magazine. John Huntsman. I actually think John Huntsman is a fascinating prospect to be president. He's got some problems in being viewed too much as a moderate, but here he is, ambassador to China, and he's right here in the top 10, and no one has ever heard of John Huntsman outside of the junkie
community.
But if
you did the top 10 Democrats in 2008, aside from...
You're talking about 2007.
2007, right. Aside from Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards, a lot of them were... Well, no, and Joe Biden.
How about Chris Dodd? I mean,
the American people knew who Chris Dodd or Bill Richardson were?
Well, Bill Richardson had done a number of things on the international stage. He had been the UN ambassador. There were some other...
I'm just saying that for us to decide in March 2011 that these guys nobody ever heard of, when we start getting into the debates, which are coming up soon, when we get into beyond Labor Day, when the race will presumably be in full throttle,
Here are the dark horses, all right? Rick Santorum lost by almost 20 points the last time he was on a ballot. Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, he's in New Hampshire. That doesn't make sense at all.
He is in New Hampshire, and that makes no sense at all. One delegate in 2008 when he was still riding the 9/11.
Yeah, I kind of think that he had a shot. If he had a shot, obviously, and I never thought he did, but if he had a shot, it was 4 years ago, no longer.
Here's something kind of special we haven't seen before, in my experience, a father and son team. Ron Paul, Rand Paul.
Right.
Ron Paul has run for president several times.
Ron Paul has ran, and Rand Paul has rinned.
I'm going to give you till next week to work on that.
Yeah.
All right, the Pauls. We do know this about the Pauls. Rand has said he will not run against his father. But we don't know if his father has made the same pledge.
Yeah, but the only polls that count are the ones on Election Day.
I'm just going to let that stay.
I'm very happy with that.
All right, I just want to finish this list because it's pretty amazing, this list. All right, Herman Cain, the godfather of Godfather's Pizza.
Right.
African-American businessman and part-time minister. He is running. Donald Trump, because he has been making noises and going on television. And Jim DeMint, who is, in his own way, the leader of the Tea Party in the United States Senate and who was responsible for choosing a lot of candidates who ran against more conventional Republican candidates for the Senate last year.
I mean, I don't think he runs, and I think
I don't think he runs.
I think he loves his power position of power in the Senate, but boy, if he decided to run, that would sure change the importance of South Carolina in a hurry.
Yes, it would, because that would do what Tom Harkin did to Iowa, kill it. There would be no importance to South Carolina. So I doubt he runs. I doubt two-thirds of these people run. I think it's entirely possible that out of this list of 15 or 16, counting the Pauls as two, you will only see four or five actually run for president.
But that's usually the case.
I'm just saying that there seems to be a almost wild-eyed search going on in the Republican Party. At a time of ascendance for the conservative point of view, there is no question this is a moment of ascendance for the conservative point of view in the last year or two years, say, every point since the inauguration of Barack Obama, that has been the ascendancy. And yet this is their field of candidates, and I know it's still early, but it's not that early by contemporary standards for people to be in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina.
Well, two things. First of all, I think part of it is that there's a feeling that as well as the Republicans did on November 2nd, there's still a sense that Barack Obama is not going to be a pushover. Certainly not going to be a pushover. As a matter of fact, if I had to bet right now, I think he wins re-election.
Well, he's right around 50%, which is usually an indicator. If he can stay there, which he may not, that generally indicates re-election.
And what does that mean? Ronald Reagan was 43% in the polls in this time in 1983, and he only
did okay, as I recall.
I think he lost Minnesota.
He did. He did lose Minnesota.
And that was it.
There you have it. All right. Speaking of losing, Claire McCaskill lost the high ground, shall we say, on her reelection campaign in Missouri this past week. Really messy situation.
Claire Eyre is what the Republicans are calling it. But there were several mistakes here. One, of course, is that she didn't pay taxes on a plane that she and her husband owned.
This was not a plane that they were using.
Right, their own, right.
This was their own plane, and there's a property tax on that in the state of Missouri.
It's now $300,000, apparently, the back taxes that she has to pay. That's the latest number I saw. Now, yes, she can conduct Senate business on private planes, but apparently she's also done at least one, perhaps as many as three, overtly political trips and bill taxpayers for that. You don't do that remember the the summer of 2009, the town hall meetings where the Tea Party showed its face, that started in the Claire McCaskill event in Missouri. So you know the Tea Party is very anxious about that. You know that fiscal responsibility is very important as an issue. And plus, Claire McCaskill has always been, I don't want to say holdier than thou, but she's always been, well, Tom Daschle should have known better. Well, Tim Geithner, I mean, she's always
been
the kind of...
She's not been shy about criticizing others right. who have had similar lapses that were not nearly as egregious.
Exactly. And, you know, yes, there's a Republican primary, and they could beat each other up, and Claire McCaskill could benefit, and it's a year away.
It is a year away.
I think this is something that could really, really hurt, and it's something that's not going to disappear.
This is a person who, when she emerged as part of the class of 2006, she beat a sitting senator in Jim Talent. She represented in many ways the on-the-march new generation of Democrats. She's done a lot for the Democratic Party in Missouri, and for this all to hit her at this particular moment in time is extremely bad news for
the Senate. And, you know, this is a Senate seat that can seem to re-elect its incumbents. It was John Ashcroft who won in 94. He lost it in 2000 to Mel Carnahan,
who was already deceased,
who had died in a plane crash 2 weeks prior, and then his widow Jean Carnahan was appointed to the seat. But then Jim Talent beat her in 2002, and then Claire McCaskill beat Talent in 2006. It's very possible that Claire McCaskill may have trouble winning re-election in 2012.
At the end of the podcast, we sometimes say goodbye to people who have left us in the past week. One of them was, in this case, Warren Christopher, who was the Secretary of State in the Clinton administration, but is probably best remembered as the person who negotiated the return of the hostages from Tehran in 1980 at the end of the Carter administration.
Right, but politically, he was the Al Gore point person in the Florida recount whose decision-making regarding what counties to push a recall for did not turn out well for the Al Gore campaign. So, of course, yes, and he also was Secretary of State during the Kosovo War, the Dayton Accords, so he got some credit for that as well. But ultimately, in the political sphere of things...
He's remembered for the 2000 contest that he lost, in essence, to Jim Baker, who was strategizing for George W. Bush.
And just one more passage, somebody who briefly played a role in political life, the former wife of the former Senator of Virginia, John Warner... Elizabeth Taylor, of course, died this week, age 79, and an amazing actress and a beautiful woman, and she left us this week as well.
Only on It's All Politics would Elizabeth Taylor be remembered as Mrs. John Warner. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
How strangely awake I feel. As if living had been just a long dream. Someone else's dream. Now finished at last. But that now will begin a dream of my own.